It's one thing for communicators to establish and share best practices amongst themselves about how to effectively deal with the media, but do those practices really matter to the media? What are the best practices to engage when trying to promote your message or defend your situation? What is the true value of storytelling and being authentic in your communications? Well, get set to hear from one of Canada's most recognized news correspondents here at home, in the United States, and around the world. Kevin Newman joins us on this edition of Speaking of Media, the podcast where communicators and the media come together to consider the world of mass storytelling. I'm Keith Marnock, former journalist turned corporate communicator, and I'm hoping that you, as a communicator, or someone who speaks on behalf of your organization, will join me for each episode to learn from industry experts on both sides of the media microphone about tangible ways to share your stories and messages, and also, perhaps more importantly, how to avoid getting caught in a negative media storm. Throughout, I will be drawing on my professional communications experiences that have spanned more than 30 years. Kevin Newman's media career played out over a similar period of time, launching his involvement in journalism from his early days at Western University in London, Ontario, through a meteoric rise in the TV news business, including lead roles at CTV, CBC, and the Global Television Network in Canada, as well as a celebrated period of his work at ABC News in the United States. In our discussion, Kevin provides a frank view of how media react to what communicators offer him and his colleagues. He also gives an insightful perspective on the state of broadcast journalism in an era where social media has become so pervasive. When I had the pleasure of speaking with him, I found his views to be relevant and important for this podcast. He spoke with a communicator audience in mind. And so we welcome Kevin Newman to Speaking of Media podcast. Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on the cast.
Thanks for the invite.
There's probably no one higher placed than you in this country to speak and consider the state of journalism here in Canada and around the world. Your resume is just a string of superlatives. But two things to start. One of us went to journalism school, and the other one realized an amazing journalism career. And the second one is many communicators might easily identify with the call letters CBC, CTV, CIII, and ABC, but they may not be aware of CHRW. Can you kind of string a few of those letters together for us, just to kind
well,
of?
Well, I didn't go to journalism school, but I played in journalism when I was at Western. I helped start up a news department at the campus radio station CHRW, and sort of I went and ordered a couple of books from the Columbia School of Journalism one summer, and started reading about journalism. I was kind of interested in it. I wasn't sure it was going to be my profession, but I thought, well, you know, university is a great time to try stuff out. So I taught myself that summer, according to these books that Columbia had put out. And then we started up the station, and I made my mistakes by doing instead of sort of classroom work. And I mean, I think the benefit of it was that I understood that there were real stakes. That if you did make a mistake, you were broadcasting. You weren't just, you know, giving a project to a prof. So, you know, that was a good early lesson that you have to be really, really certain about, you know, what you put out there, because you have to stand by it. And there's always, you know, lawyers at the ready if you've made a mistake.
I imagine, and I've heard you say previously, that curiosity was a real driver for you. You weren't in journalism, but what was it that sort of lit a fire under you?
I was always a news junkie, you know, from the time that I was a teenager. I'd be the guy to be watching conventions, you know, I watch inaugurations, I watch election nights, and that would be my jam. So I was always interested in journalism. I wasn't sure I was tough enough for journalism. That's why the campus radio was so good. But I remember this very clearly. I was working at CHRW. We were up and running. And I called the London Theater because I wanted to interview Leonard Nimoy, who, of course, spent years as Spock on Star Trek. And he was in London on a one-man play about Malvolio's brother, Da Vinci's brother. Is it Da Vinci's brother, Theo? I think so. Anyway, and I called up and I said, yeah, this is Kevin Newman from CHRW. I'd like to interview Mr. Nimoy. And the answer came back, what time would you like? And I thought, holy cow, like the thing that this journalism thing, if you represent by, you know, an organization, you can get a backstage pass to anything. And, you know, I have a wide interest. And so theater was one of them. Sports was another. News was another. And it was amazing to me that I could get as close to the front of the line to witness things and to talk to people as anybody can.
That sounds very familiar to somebody I know. Being able to kind of get backstage, get behind the scenes of avocations or things that you're interested in, it can be a wonderful way to open those kind of doors.
Yeah, you learn a little about a lot. You don't learn a lot about a little. So you can like if you're like me and you have like a wide variety of interests, and most of the reporters generally are general assignment reporters. They're not experts at anything, but you can have a dinner conversation about a wide variety of things.
I love your insight about, you know, you can go out and find out about it. But when you're actually reporting on it, you have that added pressure or that added check that you need to be good at it and not only be accurate, but in some cases, if you're in broadcast, perhaps even entertaining with the way that you provide or relate the information.
No, and that accountability piece, I think, is really important because, you know, lots of people say, well, I read it on social media. And one of the things I tell people, and some of them are my friends, and we've just been through an incredible, and we're still in it, an incredible era of misinformation, disinformation, is that if you're a professional journalist, you have to stand by your work because it can be challenged because you're posting it on CBC, you're posting it, you're reporting it on Global or whatever. And so people can sue you if you're wrong, if you defame somebody, if the information is inaccurate. The thing about social media posts is they don't exist anywhere. It's a platform and they're all over the world. So the legal profession can't go to Twitter and say, I'm going to sue you in Ontario because of something that I read in Ontario. You can't get them. So the thing about social media is that, and this is what I tell everybody, is that like, there's no accountability if you're wrong. But if you're a journalist, there's enormous accountability if you're wrong. People will sue you for, and I've been sued for millions. Thankfully, none of them worked, but they try to intimidate you that way. And so there's an accountability side to what journalism is, and there's no accountability on what you read on social media.
We used to hear about, you know, integrity, trusted media, you know, some news organizations would use that as taglines for the news organizations that they supported and so on. But that's really one of the separators now. I know that you're, an advocate for investing in trusted and obvious news sources and trying to speak in how that intersects or interplays, I suppose, with social media. What onus is on traditional news sources to separate themselves from, you know, less than reputable or fringe type media?
Well, I think traditional mainstream media needs to be, you know, much more transparent and explanatory about their process. We're still not explaining how we reach the conclusions that we reach well enough. We still think that there are enough people out there that will trust us. And frankly, there aren't. You know, the numbers of people who mistrust mainstream media are growing. But that issue of trust, I think, is important, you know, not only for media, but for anybody in communications. Because human beings naturally want to develop a relationship with the people that are providing them information on either side. And learning to trust that somebody is being fair and accurate and open is a process. So if you're a company, your brand isn't just what you broadcast in the same way that what I say isn't just that. The reason people might believe me a little bit more than the other person that they're reading on online is that they have a relationship with me. And so brands, I think, and in communications, you know, corporate officers, it's no use copying what we do and broadcasting from the mount. You have to look at everything as a relationship trust builder. And that takes a whole lot of time. It takes a whole lot of commitment, and it takes a conversation that you have to have about what do we stand for? What are our principles? Where is our moral core? How are we helping people? All those kinds of soft discussions that, you know, many corporations don't have, and journalists need to have more. So those conversations, I think, are the conversations for the future for any kinds of communications, because you have to come from a point of authenticity and truth. Otherwise, you risk, you know, not only self-destruction, but you risk in a corporate sense, you risk not being able to attract the kind of people you want in your company. You have to have thought about, you know, where do we want impact? How do we want impact? How do we treat people? Do we stand by our products? Are they making the world better? Are they making something better? And those aren't necessarily discussions that have gone on, you know, up until now. And I think they need to.
In terms of myself talking to communicators and training and teaching communicators, especially in, you know, large public facing issues or crisis situations, trying to get either communicators or having senior leaders acknowledge that being more transparent and more authentic can actually aid in a response when a company or an organization is up against it with media. Have you seen the difference between a company that shuts down or the one that's actually willing to come forward and address issues? I'm thinking from the investigative world, your time with W5 and so on, obviously you're challenging people. Would you say that it's accurate that those who actually show up for an interview or do respond actually probably get a better shake in the end than those who really try to turtle and, you know, try to ignore what's facing them?
Yeah, I mean, we are under an obligation to try to get the other side of the story. And even though it's, I've sat across from so many CEOs as an investigative reporter and felt for them, because they know that I'm prepared. I know that they're prepared. And it's excruciating. But I have to believe that, you know, the simple statement that says no comment on the part of the viewer or on the part of the consumer is seen as an admission of guilt, that you have to sit there and take your licks. And most people, if they're well prepared and if they've really thought it through and it's not just like messaging crap, but if they have a real point to make, as a journalist, I have to allow them to make that point. That's my legal obligation and it's my principled obligation. And, you know, there will be some, you know, nasty reporters out there that, you know, might not use the whole phrase. But I think overall, yes, I believe that being seen to stand up for your company, being seen to stand up for a principle and admit when something is wrong and a mistake has been made is entirely to the benefit of your brand. That, you know, so many times I've said, here's the statement from the company, but it's meaningless. You know, that's not really going to help them much. I have also seen people come on camera who are not prepared and who have not thought this through, who have listened to their lawyers who are saying, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, don't talk. And so they've got deer in the headlights and they look guilty. The better discussion to have is like, where was I wrong? What are the implications of admitting I'm wrong? How do I make things better? And what pledge can I make to what I'm taking to correct the mistake? Because, you know, again, it's about trust. It's about a human relationship. And if you are just a piece of paper as a corporation, you're not winning that argument.
We've talked in the past about sort of the half issue, and you mentioned it, issuing a statement. And I realize that in certain circumstances, there are scenarios or there's elements that make corporations or companies think that way. But in essence, a company is, you know, technically responding, but they're not really open to being tested on that or being questioned beyond that. We see that, again, south of the border, when a president believes that he's had all his communication channels cut off, when he doesn't have Twitter to refer to, when he's got a briefing room in his house. But again, just for communicators, when you decide to issue a statement, you know, the realities of that are that, yes, you have responded, but I can't believe that that's ever really taken very well. And although you may feel an obligation to at least refer to it, you're basically going to be giving, if there's an opposition or someone who's contrary to what the company's doing, that gives the other side a real field day to go after whatever the issue might be.
Well, and you don't know that I don't have an employee of yours, a senior employee that has already gone on camera and has accused you of many things, right? I'm not going to tell you that because that's not part of what investigations do. So you may find yourself by a simple statement, like contradicting somebody in your own company or somebody who's been a customer or somebody else, and you don't have complete control over the messaging at that point. Right. So I think it's important to say that you should never, ever speak an untruth. And almost 100% of the time, it's the cover-up that gets people. It's not the initial problem. So, you know, quite often you can get people in positions who are listening to, you know, forgive me, lawyers, but listening to lawyers a little too much, that think that if they just put this out, you know, and if it's not entirely truthful, that it'll go away. But in 40 years of journalism, I can tell you that, you know, as soon as you put out something that's untruthful, there are many other people who are going to call me up and tell me that that's untruthful and provide the evidence likely to prove that it's untruthful. And then you're in real trouble.
Right. Think about as we're talking about this, the role of and the choice of spokesperson for an organization. We talk a lot about the various elements that can go into making a decision on who that might be, how far up the chain you want to elevate it. For me, I'm always feeling like someone who's emotionally intelligent, who has obviously enough clout to, you know, represent, but also perhaps look forward on an issue, is someone who is good to put forward.
Yeah, I think that's key. And it's not only key just for like what you tell a reporter, but all of your employees are going to watch that interview too. And so that person isn't just, you know, speaking externally for the company, they're speaking internally as well. So someone, as you said, with an emotional EQ, somebody who can frame a story around something, and someone who genuinely feels the words that they're saying is better. And it's not just because it's better television. It's better because you're also sending a signal to, you know, the people inside your shop that it's okay. You work for a company that learns from its mistakes, or you work for a company that cares about getting things right. And in some ways that's almost more important because you know, today's workforce, you know, they, more and more people want to believe in the work that they do. It's not enough to get the paycheck and to do a good job. There's a connection on a moral level. And so, you know, somebody who can't frame things that way, doesn't think that's important, is going to, you know, not be the best person, I think, to put forward. I do think that EQ and someone who genuinely is truthful and human is a better spokesperson in most cases.
I want to come back to a few of those things, but I also want to, I think most of our audience will know exactly the trajectory of your career, but just want to go back a little bit here and just sort of validate all these things that you're telling us and why it's so special to have you on the show. So in 1994, you had already worked for Global and CTV, and you would have been anchoring, I guess, midday on CBC News World, if that's correct.
And yeah, it was a new newscast on the CBC network across the country.
And things were looking, from a viewer's point of view, pretty rosy. But behind the scenes and with you, there were a lot of decisions and challenges coming your way.
TV business is kind of brutal. Yeah, no, I was about to be replaced, and then they didn't have another place for me, or they didn't communicate it well enough. So I took another job offer.
And so that's what I want to talk about. So you went north, south of the border in a rather celebrated way. You worked at ABC News. You found yourself on Good Morning America, and you were anchoring and corresponding for World News and all its various shows and so on under Peter Jennings. Of course. And for people who don't know, that a Canadian as well. I'm always curious to know how much the Canadian heritage was referred to in the newsroom, because it certainly was never really very evident on air. It was sort of a morally safer secret, I've always said. You know,
it was like this little club. I mean, and Peter Jennings put it right. I mean, the Canadians in news organizations in the States have a distance. It's not our country. And so we report on it perhaps a little bit more critically and a little more clearly, because we're not as fully vested. Although Peter later became an American, and especially after 9/11, that sort of convinced him that he was American and Canadian.
Right.
And I sort of came around to that as well. But looking at anything with a level of distance and a level of dispassion is better. You know, when you're feeling sort of enveloped in emotion, it can be tricky. I mean, there was one place though that it was a negative for me, and that's, you know, I hadn't grown up in a country where, you know, a large majority of people were African Americans. And so I wasn't as attuned to the racial prejudice that they grew up with as I needed to be if I was reporting in America. But I had many great buddies and friends that schooled me in that, African-American producers and many others. But yeah, so in many ways it was better. In a few ways, it was a disadvantage.
And then in many respects, you could have been the next, if there was this, the next Lloyd Robertson or the next Knowlton Nash or Peter Mansbridge. You were up for anchoring both of those national newscasts at one point, I believe. But your career, in, you know, for different reasons, went a different way. I've got to think, as sort of a fairly close watcher, that might have brought a great variety to your career that you might not have otherwise been pursuing, but it kind of fell into and really took advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, after the American experience, which was good, I learned a heck of a lot. I wanted to create something. And so Global, you know, the third network in Canada, gave me the opportunity to create their new national newscast, help create it. And so we created Global National, and it's still there. And I, you know, anyone watching this that's created something that lasts, you know, it's really special. It's like a startup that succeeded. And so, you know, when I look back in my varied career, that one's probably the most special to me because we started with nothing. And 5 years later, we were the leading national newscast, beating the other guys. Yeah. So, you know, that felt really good because that was creation. And that was me and a very small group of people acting on instincts and trying to find a new audience for national news where one hadn't existed. And it worked.
Yeah, it was amazing. Congratulations. So speaking of Global National, you were a part of that sort of founding group, and 9/11 comes along. After moving over from ABC, I can tell you that this is maybe somebody who you worked with, Aaron Brown. It was 9/11 was his first day at CNN on his way to work.
It was my fourth day at
Global
National.
4 days after you started, correct? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it was a brand new network and 16 hours. And, you know, sometimes, as you know, some of your listeners may know, you know, things forged in fire mature quicker. And I think that was the case for us.
Any reminiscences about 9/11, knowing that it was really at the start of that grand project that you had, you know, in essence created?
Yeah, it was. It's interesting. It's coming up to the 20th anniversary of it. So, you know, this is history for a good number of people. Mm-hmm. But for my generation of journalists, this was the seminal event. And the reason was, is, you know, up until that time, there weren't any Canadian reporters who had covered Canadian troops in combat in two generations. We didn't have war correspondents other than ones that lived in London and covered other people's wars. But this was a small group of very young journalists who suddenly had a catastrophic story to cover that was scary, that impacted their families, that impacted everything about, you know, our two countries. And so it became sort of the defining, I think, experience, because it's, you know, the Afghan war is only now winding down and it looks like the Taliban is going to be back in charge. But that's a 20-year span that we've all covered. So I think for our generation, that was it. I think for this generation, of course, misinformation, the Trump years, you know, the disintegration of trust in our profession is the story that they'll probably remember best.
I feel like it was around that time when network news, especially in the States, that's when you started to sense that networks were kind of going into their own corners.
Yeah.
Fox News coming forward, the Bush years and so on. From a broadcast network standpoint, you know, it's obviously been very accentuated in the last 4 years. Is that something that you can kind of pull back on? Is that something that's...
You know what? Those guys are making too much money at this, unfortunately. And you know, the thing I have to remind everybody too is that, like, that hasn't happened in Canada. You know, our all news stations are still pretty much covering the news. So if you're engaging with an all news station, CBC, CTV, Global, you could pretty well count on getting a fair shake. But I mean, I watch CNN, I watch MSNBC, I watch Fox News, and those are opinion networks. They're no longer news networks. And I mean, the reason that they're making so much money is not only ratings, but they don't have to invest in covering the news. They put four people on a desk in a studio and away they go. And that's cheap as hell. Right. So, I mean, they've been able to reduce the cost. They still call themselves a news network, but in my humble opinion, they're more opinion networks. And they're kind of tainting what everyone thinks news is. You know, I have many discussions with friends of mine about how, you know, news is all opinion. And I'm going, yeah, those guys are doing that, but they're actually really small amount. Like, if you look at the leading ratings of CNN in all of America, maybe 1 million, 1.3 million at their highest. That's the same audience that Lisa LaFlamme has at CTV National News. So because we're in the business of communications, they loom larger than they do in reality. So what I try to do is try to remind people that, yeah, they're the opinion networks, but not everybody is doing that. And in fact, you reach a bigger audience on the CBS Evening News or ABC's News or CTV National News. And that is a balanced, real journalism. But unfortunately, it's not as fiery and it's not as, you know, it's not as electric and maybe it's not as entertaining. That's sort of my view of the landscape right now.
I look at, you know, your final year sort of doing work on W5, and I think about 60 Minutes. Do you still feel that there's still an influence in investigative network journalism?
Not as much, to be honest. I mean, the numbers... There has been a reduction overall, but, you know, more people watch 60 Minutes than any other newscast, and they're always in the top 10 in the United States. Mm-hmm. People forget that. I worked at W5 for 5 years. We went up against Hockey Night in Canada. We had the worst time slot you could possibly have in Canadian television, and we averaged between 600 and a million viewers. On a Saturday night at 7 against hockey. So my answer to your question is yes. Those are still influential. A lot of people still watch them. Not as many as used to, for sure. There's been a decline, although not in the last year. The news has never had more ratings this year than it has in the last 15 years. But if you think, you know, you need to get on BNN or you need to get on, you know, the all news networks, understand that you're not reaching many people, if that's what you want to do. If you're all going on BNN, you're reaching, you know, the traders. If that's what you want to do, then go to BNN. But like, that's, you know, 35,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. They're influential. But if what you want to do is to reach your customers, if you want to reach the masses, you know, you can go on the all news networks and get maybe 75,000, or you can still try to get on, you know, any national newscast and you're over 600,000.
Right.
I mean, there's still powerful draws. The audience is older, no question. And how do you reach a younger audience? Well, I think you reach a younger audience by imagining that if you, as a company, begin to think about investing in content creation, we're beginning to see that, right? We're beginning to see some of the big brands that are creating content that really has nothing to do with the brand other than a feeling, other than an association with somebody whose principles are good. You know, Kaepernick and all that stuff, right? I believe that brands and companies and CEOs that understand that an investment in content puts you in a place in people's minds in a way that advertising won't, and in a way that public relations doesn't do much of. Public relations, I think, is great for when you're in trouble. But if you really want to engage people's minds, you have to start thinking about authentic content that's good and well-funded and done by professionals. And then you've got space in that mind space, because I mean, we all know young people, they've been marketed to hell and they have huge bullshit meters. Yep. And so, you know, imagining that you can talk to them the same way you would talk to people our age, it's just not true.
You've interviewed world leaders, celebrities, athletes at Olympic Games, you know, people who found themselves in the news because of tragedy. Has that human connection or that human story changed much over the years now that we've got more ways to echo it out? Or is it, you know, at the heart of it, a great story is a great story?
Yeah. Great story, well told, period, end of sentence.
Yeah.
You know, and that's true of any communicator, that if you can tell a good story and tell it well, it's going to connect. I mean, think of it yourself. I mean, if you think of your own life, where have you heard great stories? It's around a campfire. It's someone relays it to you. And think of how well you remember that, right? That's the power of storytelling. It's a connection to memory and to humanity that sticks. And so if you're a communicator and you're not telling stories that stick, if you're just saying words and phrases and stuff to get the monkey off your back or whatever, then you're not really communicating, right? Where's the emotion? What's the emotional connection? To me, and in all my broadcasting and in my anchoring and in my reporting, I would always say, how do I make an emotional connection? Because then I'm communicating, right? Then somebody is going, I could be that person. I'm not like that person. I'm glad I'm not that person, but they're having a conversation because they're emotionally engaged. And if you're not, as a communicator, if you're not thinking about that emotional connection, then you're just talking words. You're not really communicating.
Has there ever been, you know, a world leader, a newsmaker that's surprised you in terms of storytelling and that things you weren't expecting that came out of nowhere or something that you were really memorable?
Yeah. Those are the best, right?
I know that you interviewed Mandela, for example. Would that have been?
Yeah, I did. And that was more intimidating for me than anything. I mean, he was just out of jail and just emerging in the world. And, you know, the only thing I could think to ask him is, why aren't you more bitter? Like, if I was you. But, you know, any interview that I remember is the one where someone came with a good story to tell. You know, whether it was Tom Hanks, whether it was, you know, Robin Williams, whether it was Cher, they all know, like in an interview, that there's a story to be told. And but those aren't the ones that I tend to remember. The ones I tend to remember, and maybe this is just because it made me feel better, was the people who turned to me because no one else would listen. And so something bad had happened to them. And they had lived with it and they had tried to fix it as best they could. And eventually they picked up a phone and they said, can I just tell my story to you? Because I don't think this is right. And as a reporter, you can't go to every story like that, but you do your research and you figure out, no, there's what's happened to this person might happen to somebody else too. And to sit across from somebody who has not been listened to and give them the opportunity to speak their truth. I think that's the thing that I loved most about it all was that I always told them, I said, I'm not sure I can help you. I'm not sure that something's going to be fixed, but I want you to know that I will listen to you and that others will listen to you. And usually that's enough to give them peace.
And that's likely a product out of the fact that they knew of you and trusted you, you feel?
Yeah, I think that was the key to trust, was that they thought that I would not screw them.
I do know that you had an interest in an advocacy for innovation, your connection with KW and the community and so on.
Yep.
I guess I'm talking to people who are maybe actually going to journalism school, you know, be it Carleton or Western or Ryerson or whatever, hearing that they're probably, you know, not as many jobs in journalism, but the communication might be a, you know, an outcome for them. What do you say to people like that who are wanting to do this, not sure if they can, maybe have to do on the side? What's the message that you give them now?
Well, I'm honest with them and I say, like, it's really hard I mean, when I was fortunate, I came through journalism when it was a profession where you might even have benefits. Although, you know, the last 20 years of my profession, I didn't have any benefits. But it was possible to have a job and support a family mostly. There were times I had two jobs because journalism didn't pay enough. You have to think of it as a trade, I tell them. And that, you know, if you are curious and if you're passionate and if you have enough good tools, if you learn to write, and if you travel in your life so you have things to say, you'll be fine. You just have to be willing to admit that, you know, you might not work for the Globe and Mail. You might not be on CBC's National. You might be somebody who, like my son, who works in advertising in Australia, but who tells beautiful stories about, you know, Aboriginal engagement for airlines. You know, there are a lot of new kinds of jobs. I was talking about this content thing that has started to grow with brands. There's a lot of good work coming that way. And it's not pure advertising. It's not pure public relations. It's authentic storytelling, honest, emotional, visual storytelling that brands want people to feel good when they think about them. And so there's stuff to be done. Public relations, I think, you know, I don't know a whole lot about what kind of training people are getting. I'm always astounded that there are so many people that are focused on press releases, because I can tell you, as somebody from the inside, nobody has time to read them, you know, and for heaven's sakes, don't fax them, because faxes were pulled out of newsrooms 25 years ago. And I'm astounded how many people fax out press releases still. So don't bother, you know, it's good for the record. You can, you know, if you need, someone wants to refer to it and Google it later, it's for that. But if you think any reporter is going to pick up a press release and run off to interview you, not usually. You have to work harder at it, and you have to develop relationships yourself, with people. And, again, you have to be trustworthy, and you have to be honest. And then you have to project that. And if you are successful at that, then you'll be able to tell stories in many different places.
And that probably goes for both sides, as I like to say, of the media microphone. And if we were all going down that road a little bit more consistently, we'd probably have a little bit better understanding of the world around us. And so
true. Yeah.
Kevin, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join the podcast. You know, talking about authenticity and being genuine. You don't know that I know what a great guy you are, but you know, we've certainly kind of crossed paths. I've watched your career really closely and really admired, you know, all that you've done.
Oh, thanks, man.
The decisions that you've made. And I think, you know, Canadians are really proud to know that you were one of the guys that was on the front row of, you know, making news real for people in the last 30 years. And, you know, on behalf of them, I want to thank you. And I know that, your humanity shines through, not just in the work you've done, but certainly through the time and the insights that you offered us here today. So thanks again.
Oh, thanks,
I know you're retired, but I hope you'll keep finding ways to tell stories and keeping people honest in the way that they tell stories. And yeah, I really look forward to seeing maybe a little bit more out of you, even if you're not, you know, punching the clock from 9 to 5.
All right. Listen, that's very kind. And you're very generous. Thank you.
All right. Kevin Newman here on Speaking of Media.
And just as Kevin said, that he always appreciated the opportunity to speak to people he admired or was curious about, it was certainly the same for me during this episode with him. I was struck by the context Kevin offered on the rise of social media and how that relates to the politically charged, well-financed news networks in the US, and how that level of editorial bias has not yet come to Canada, thankfully. I appreciated hearing that Kevin felt that authenticity and trust need to be so central to your ongoing communications, and the degree to which not showing up or being inauthentic can actually damage your brand. While most of us are not routinely approached by network-level news outlets and tough, well-prepared news people like Kevin Newman, it is important to conduct yourself as if that is the case on a day-to-day basis, so that when you do find yourself in a bright public spotlight, you show up with confidence and competence to face media scrutiny. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed piecing it together. I hope to keep bringing you the best in the business from both sides of the media microphone who will help you to better develop and deliver your messages and stories. For now, thanks for connecting. Speaking of Media is available on all podcast platforms, including Google and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, to name a few. I hope you will listen, like, and subscribe to the cast, as this will help us expand the show's reach and the quality of its content. Also, you can simply ask your smart device for Speaking of Media by name. Please consider joining our Speaking of Media Communicators discussion group on Facebook. You'll also find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and on Twitter at Media Speaking. I'm Keith Marnock, and through other episodes, I look forward to our next time together when we will be speaking of media.